Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our part three of our town hall series that we've entitled Colliding Pandemics, Loss, Grief, and Race During COVID-19. I'm Mike Anderson. I'm proud to serve as the president of UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals. I'll be serving as the MC today. A little preview as we begin our recovery work or continue our recovery work. We're also beginning a series of Cross Bay Recovery Town Halls to keep you updated on our progress on our recovery efforts, the work of our Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, and also the ongoing COVID-19 response. Obviously, the pandemic will still be with us for quite some time, unfortunately. Our first recovery town hall is next Tuesday, June 23rd at 12 noon. It's Cross Bay, and everybody should be receiving an invitation to that town hall very, very soon. You know, I talk about healthy children, healthy communities, and a healthy world all the time. I believe that's core to who we are as a children's hospital. But we are also an anchor institution, a place that the community looks to in good times and in trying times. And as we've heard in our first two town halls, it's really our purpose and place to dismantle racism and eradicate inequalities. But we've heard your comments loud and clear. We can't do that without accountability. We can't do that without language, and we can't do that without some really tough conversations. So I want to thank you for being here today, for your courage and conviction to come together and to really hold hard truths. Today, we'll be providing a foundational understanding of one of our core approaches that we'll use to organize this work towards diversity, equity, and inclusion, that being cultural humility. Once again, the results from our needs assessment show that we've still got a lot of work to do, and that we need a common language as we embark on these delicate discussions about race and racism. So we've got a terrific panel lined up. We're also going to hear from some great colleagues, some African-American men from our community, and really have some honest discussion with them on how Benioff Children's Hospital is doing and what we need to do better, what we need to do even better going forward. So it's once again terrific to have here. I'm so honored that you would take an hour out of your busy day. I'd like to turn it now briefly to Jamie Phillips, our Chief Operating Officer, and Dr. Steve Wilson, our Chief Medical Officer, for some opening comments.
Great. Thank you. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the San Francisco campus, and I've been with UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital in San Francisco for the majority of my career. Before we start, just to echo what Dr. Anderson alluded to, which is we know we have sort of put a pause a little bit on the communication related to the other pandemic of COVID-19, and questions have been coming in related to that. We will address some of them in the upcoming electronic newsletter that will be coming out and then subsequent town halls. So we do not mean to ignore that. It's just that obviously the issues that we're discussing about systemic racism and race are so so pertinent, so immediate, that we felt really the need to take a pause from some of the other conversations and focus on that. So the brief comments I'd like to make have to do with the role of leadership, the role of leaders in addressing some of the issues within our organization. So for myself, I like everyone else, I'm just filled with emotions around some of the issues, some of the events that we've seen unfold. I would say, with all of the sadness and upset that comes with that, I'm also extremely encouraged by what feels very new to me, which is the openness of dialogue and the sort of consistency of dialogue that's happening in our workplace. I have, in the entire time I've been with UCSF, always believed that there was a commitment to addressing the issues of systemic racism. There really hasn't been a lot of active dialogue. It hasn't been part of our daily dialogue. And that feels like a change to me and has been very meaningful. It's also caused me to turn a light on myself a little bit. As somebody who believes deeply in these issues, I have to ask myself, in what ways am I part of the problem? In what ways do I unintentionally perpetuate some of the systemic barriers that exist for people of color in our organization, for women in our organization. And I've come to the conclusion that that really without intent, but who cares about intent really, that I have been part of the problem because I haven't actively addressed issues in ways that I could. So the organizers of this town hall asked me to address a few questions, at which I will do very briefly. So first, what things have I done in the past week to try and address issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion? Well, one is that in our one of our service lines, our major service lines, the leaders of that service line have asked the question of what can we do in our segment. And I've done my best to try and foster rather than put those conversations to the side and really encourage that these issues of systemic racism and barriers for staff within that service line are real and deserve to be at the front of the conversation, not as an add-on at the end, and things where we need to focus on action rather than simply discussion. So we are starting to form active groups to address how we can foster career advancement for people of color within the service line and how we can change the way we address and open up opportunities either for internal advancement or for people as we're recruiting new people into the service line. And I'm committed to doing that, and I think others in the organization are committed to expanding that approach and really having it be part of the core agenda that we structurally and consistently address. So the second and third questions that were raised to me, I think are interconnected and interwoven, which is how can we interweave diversity, equity, and inclusion into our daily practice and move this initiative to being, move this from being an initiative to be part of the fabric of our organization. And then the other question is how do we move from accountability to action? So to me, those are really intertwined questions which have to do with how do we stop talking and start doing? So I obviously am not someone who comes with tremendous expertise, but I do come to this with commitment to doing so. So I would say the important things are going to be structural. As leaders in DCH, we need to acknowledge our own roles and our own capacity to make change and bring about change. We have to be open and good listeners as well as good talkers when it comes to addressing inherent inequities in the workplace. And we need to establish structures that will lead to steady and sustained change. I think these are things that we all care about, but we may be put to the side. And if in closing, if I would say if there's anything that we can do as leaders, whether we are people of color or we're not people of color, we need to really be real about the fact that action is what's needed. We're going to need to make changes and address barriers. We're going to need to be more open when opportunities come up and not just talk to the person we're comfortable with about maybe taking on a new opportunity, but instead really cast a broad net of who might be interested and interested in those advancements and recognize that there might be people that we don't think of or we don't immediately, that don't immediately come to mind that may bring talents that are unrecognized. So rather than take more time away from our talented panelists, I'm going to stop at this point and hand off to Jamie. But I really appreciate the opportunity to be part of this discussion.
Thank you, Steve. In particular around action, there's been a couple things that leadership has been working on to give you some further information. So the DEI committee is actively coming with a request for resources of what's needed in our upcoming fiscal year. And they're going to present that to the senior leadership team by the end of the month. Once that gets reviewed, we can have that communication of what we're going to focus specific energies around that was recommended by the council. The other thing that I personally did, I haven't shared it with leadership yet, but I still need to go through the data. I went back and just pulled the representation of our racial breakdown, and I still need to do some work on this, but just to give you reference. So for San Francisco, the executive seniors, there's 94% white, 6% black African American. That's not good enough. First, mid managers, white 66.7%, Asian 21.2%, blacks 4.5%, Hispanic 7.6%. Not good enough. When I look at Oakland, if I look at clinical management, 8% Asian, 15% black, and Hispanic 12%. Not good enough. When I look at non-clinical management, 15% Asian, 27% black, Hispanic 11%. Not bad, but we could do better. So one of the things on my radar is to work with the management and human resources about how do we better identify diverse candidates in our system. And it's actually beyond that. It's like you got to start back in high school. You got to start back when you go into college. Like, are we making enough outreach to the black colleges, to, you know, black associations, Hispanic associations, Asian associations, whatever. There's a lot of national associations, as we all know, in our professional fields. And what are we doing to get more diverse candidates? So that's on my radar. And it will be on the radar of me, not, just not Jamie Phillips. It's going to be on the radar of all the leaders in this organization. And we'll have to set goals and metrics and see how we perform towards that. The other thing I got was around the facilities of why they differ between both campuses and what are we doing about it. That one, you know, I don't know if everyone knows, but right now we probably have about $400 million that's being invested at Oakland. You might say, that's not enough. But it's $400 million. And that's to renovate, you know, inpatient areas, some support areas, and we're committed to doing that. The other thing, I don't know if you know, the board has set aside, and they're actually involved in this, looking at a new pavilion for this campus. Now, is it going to happen tomorrow? No. Because we have to go through all these approvals, but we're really trying to see in the next 10 years, can we get a pavilion on this campus? And UCSF is part of these discussions, so it's not like Oakland kind of doing their own thing and get told no, they're actively part of this. The board, like I said, is. And that is to really look at how do we reimagine this campus? So yes, I understand. The floors are not to the level of par where we want to be. Yes, I understand the rooms are not, but there is effort to make it better. And it takes time, it takes money. And we, you know, when we push around the finances, the reason why we push around the finances is so that we can build a new pavilion. And it might be that we need to refocus on things that we have done in the past that we can't, but the intention is to get a new pavilion as much as we can on this campus. That's the goal that has been shared at the board level, at the UCSF level, but we have to financially perform to get it, to make it happen. So just wanted to share that. The other piece has been around compensation, and I have Phyllis on the line because Phyllis knows way more detail than I do on how we look at salaries. So I'm going to turn it to her so that she can give a better understanding of why there are differences sometimes. And then I'm going to turn it over to George to talk about staffing ratios, because that's something that came up as well. So Phyllis.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie. Good afternoon. My name is Phyllis Weiss, and I serve as a hospital, Oakland Hospital's Vice President of Human Resources. And I have been asked to address the questions about wage. Some people say disparity or inequity, but it's the wage differences between Mission Bay and Oakland. As some of you know, I've been at the hospital for a cumulative period of about 18 years, so I have firsthand knowledge of the constant challenges of assuring that the hospital is sustained for the long run, some years even being more challenging than others. This year is no different with how COVID impacted our patients, our employees, and our finances. But generally, the compensation philosophy has not changed over the years. We have never been in a financial position to be a leader in wages, and we certainly don't want to be behind the market so that recruitment and retention become an issue. But we attempt to set wages somewhere in the middle. I will tell you that about 5 years ago, there was a turnover rate of less than 5%, which was pretty sparkling in the world of retention and recruitment. It's crept up a little bit now, but for other reasons, but at least we know that it's creeping up. So we're paying attention to that. In addition to market wages, another influence is demographics. And by that, I mean that wages in San Francisco are typically higher than the East Bay. Even with UC facilities that are San Francisco, there is a difference between San Francisco and their East Bay facilities. Maybe not as great as the drag that we have against Mission Bay wages, but it is there. Another component of setting wage rates is to look at an overall compensation package, which is often overlooked as part of it. But this includes wages and benefits, and in not all cases for sure, but in some areas, Oakland's benefit package is more robust than at Mission Bay. So the last component is how wages evolve via the negotiations process with our union partners. And I have to be quite frank and transparent, none of this will solve the issues of wage differences between the two campuses. But what will solve it is careful conservation of our resources now and the efforts in place to build for the future, which Jamie just mentioned. When we can then share in our financial successes by increasing wage rates within our comp philosophy and using equity adjustments as necessary to keep up with the market, which often, oh, well, we have no control of it, but often zooms away from us in ways that we didn't anticipate. And finally, we are all very well aware that the major component of the financial success of this hospital is due to the tremendous commitment and loyalty employees in Oakland and Mission Bay have, and recognition of the sacrifices as well. I want you to be sure to know that these factors are all in the forefront of the minds of leadership group as decisions are made. I hope this clarifies the issue around wage differences and how it's set between Oakland and Mission Bay. But if there are follow-up questions, please feel free to email me and I'll be happy to
And then I'll be super brief so we can get into the meat of the town hall. We, the Cross Bay Ambulatory Leadership Council for the Benioff Children's Hospitals completed a Cross Bay staffing comparative analysis by specialty and benchmark to Children's Hospital Association and MGMA. And we saw some improvements that have been made, and we identified some gaps. And in our FY21 budget, we addressed a great majority of those gaps with respect to reallocating some resources to improve some social work, nutrition, and nursing hours to different specialties. And so as we roll into the FY21 budget, we'll begin to address those incrementally through the hiring freeze process. But we've looked at it and have made improvements towards it. And then I will let the town hall continue on to the next section.
George, thank you very much. Thank you, Phyllis, Steve, and Jamie. I appreciate your input. And just to bring us back to what I said in the beginning, well, two things. First of all, from the comments you just heard in the last 15 minutes, we do take your questions and your emails and your chat seriously, take them to heart and try and address them. So we will continue that trend as these town halls continue. The second thing Steve said was, how do we go from talking to doing? I think you saw that in a couple of the early comments. And I'd like to now focus on that. It is really my pleasure to have Santoy Trotter begin to talk about a framework, a language, a way for us to approach this notion of cultural humility. So, Santoy, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. Very glad to be here with all of you. I will be sharing some definitions, some terms. Dr. Wilson spoke about, you know, how do we actually speak about this and actually all have some shared terminology. It is very difficult in our country for us to have conversations about race because race is has been racism, right, is a trauma and a wounding. And so in order to enter into those conversations, we need to have some of the same terms and some of the same words. And I want to acknowledge the terms that I'll be sharing, and some of the content comes from Trauma Transformed, a training. And a lot of that was adapted from work that happened right here at UCSF with Dr. Joyce Dorado and also Lynn Dulce and the UCSF HEARTS programs, that is healthy environmental responses to trauma in schools. So culture of humility and equity is a core component, a foundational component to a trauma-informed and healing system. It is a core guiding principle. And I will focus today, you know, often on the subject of race, because again, that is a place that is we often will avoid. And until kind of this uprising, we were avoiding often the difficulty of getting into this conversation. Culture Humility was created right here at Children's Hospital Oakland by Dr. Jan Murray Garcia and Dr. Melanie Trevelyan during a time just like today. So in the early 90s, after the brutal beating of Rodney King and the Rodney King riots and uprising, Children's Hospital Oakland had multicultural circles and gatherings where staff came together to have crucial conversations just like we are doing right now. And through that process and through their work at Children's Hospital Oakland, they came up with this concept of culture humility. And it's more than a concept. It's actually a process of communal reflection and analyzing the root causes of suffering and create a broader and more inclusive view of the world. I'm hearing many people talk about lifelong learning and critical self-reflection. And, you know, there are Google Docs on how to be an anti-racist. Netflix is, you know, sharing free videos, people are talking to each other, and that there's this critical self-reflection that needs to happen all the time. We need to hold that our nation was founded on white supremacy, on chattel slavery, and genocide of indigenous people. And that when we are not constantly working to undo that, to learn about our role inside of that, then we are complicit with the status quo, and we are complicit with white supremacy. And when the term of white supremacy, you know, I think people often think, you know, I grew up in Georgia, right? And so we think about folks with hoods, the KKK, and really white supremacy is holding up whiteness as the standard. That happened, you know, when Black folks were human, you know, and even when we think about diversity, diverse from what, right? And so again, that's holding up whiteness as the standard. And so we need to work actively to undo that. Another principle of cultural humility is recognizing and challenging power imbalances wherever that sits, right? And so as providers, as medical providers, to patient, as therapist, to client, and also internal to our interactions as staff to staff here, that we recognize where we hold power and where we hold privilege, and also holding that all of us have our privileged selves, Dr. Ken Hardy's work on our privileged selves and our subjugated selves. And so there's accountability that we all have work to do to challenge and to redress the power imbalances. Another piece that I am, you know, grateful for our institution right now is developing institutional accountability, you know, doing the work to look at our hiring practices, to look at our policies, our HR policies. I see Ms. Hardy here, and thank you for being on the panel last week from HR at our UCSF Partners in the West, but that we really are looking at and holding ourselves accountable as an institution, and we're developing mutual beneficial relationships with the community members that we serve, and we're highlighting community expertise. So when we think about trauma, often we think about kind of this individualized trauma, or even collective, right? So child abuse or COVID-19 as a trauma. And we have heard Dr. Long and others speak about social cultural trauma. So that's the trauma when we think about societal oppressions, like racism and sexism, things that we were just born into, just by nature of being born, that the experience that we have is being that your safety is threatened, right? That there's more vulnerability just by nature of who you were born to be. Right? And that can be experienced as a stressor and definitely as a trauma. And that what we're seeing now is that there's a compounded, synergistic, traumatic experience and stressful experience for people. Right, we know through the ACEs study that over, you know, 60% of us had some sort of adverse childhood experience. And then if you tie on to that, the trauma of racism for Black people, and that I will focus on race right now, that there's a synergistic traumatic experience. And so one way, you know, one example of that is we think about, you know, how are young people, how are people perceived? So you see this young man and this other gentleman here. And so if they walked into our hospital, either any of our doors for a visit, if they walked into our emergency room after, you know, how would they be perceived, right? And any of us in our best place would be like, oh, we would greet them with love and care and dignity. But think about when we're stressed and think about all of those around us. And that really holding, you know, where we need to start is that we are all breathing in the smog of racism, and that we need to actively work to undo that. And so looking at these young man on the, maybe on your left, I'm not sure, but the hat is a young man who is an Oakland Tech graduate. He had a 5.0 GPA. He graduated in 2018 from Yale and plays the French horn. The young man on the white in the plaid, the white gentleman, was a young person who was one of the shooters in the Columbine mass shooting. Right, and so just holding both of these young people experienced trauma and stress growing up. The young man on the hat is Akintunde Ahmad, Oakland proud, and the young man on the right is Dylan Klebod. So just want to remind us to think about our implicit bias, and that, you know, we see, you know, with police brutality, we see implicit bias spoken, talked a lot about in the police and criminal justice, but, you know, implicit bias is exacerbated by stress. And as healthcare professionals, our work is extremely stressful. Dr. Bell will be speaking soon, who's you know, part of our emergency room. And so we all have to take a moment to really, the way that we redress our implicit bias is being aware of it, right? Taking and knowing that we're always searching for threat. And there's a places where there's more safety and vulnerability. And so the more we're aware of our implicit biases, then we can undo that. And bias is everywhere. Right, and so this is after Katrina, and you see on the top a young Black man, and the press says that he's wading through chest deep flood waters after looting in a grocery store. And the two people, perceivably white individuals at the bottom, two residents wade through chest deep water, finding bread and soda, right? All of these people were victims at Katrina of the flood, and that it is in everywhere, the air that we breathe. You know, people at the beginning speaking about, oh, that when we're silent and we're not actually actively doing this work, then we're actually causing harm. Another definition I want to share is microaggressions, which is another form of social cultural trauma. And so it's kind of like a thousand tiny razor cuts, right? If you can imagine that. And so that's, you know, every Black man on this panel has probably been pulled over by the police. Right. I know that being followed in a store, being told last week in the panel, our Dr. Atkinson McAvoy, and please forgive me if I'm saying your name wrong, but spoke to being told she's articulate, right? With the assumption being as if I would not be, right? And so those microaggressions, those teeny tiny cuts impact us and impact people of color. And so we need to start with ourselves in this work. And then we also need to move outside organizationally. And people have heard the term historical trauma. Again, you know, chattel slavery, Black codes, Jim Crow, all of these were legal, redlining. All of these were legal policies that impacted communities of color. And I'm going to go a little bit quickly because I really want to get to the people that will be speaking on the panel. But I want to just give a definition of racism by Dr. Jones. And she says that racism is a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on the social interpretations of how one looks. Because remember, race is not biological, it's a social contract, which unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities and saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. Just holding that racism impacts all of us in our society. That there is, I'm going to skip to the institutional racism, which speaks to discrimination within our organization, and appreciate our DEI committee kind of start, and Jamie Phillips, who just kind of spoke to, you know, where we can do better to look at the racism within our institution, and the systemic racism inside of our healthcare systems, our criminal justice system, our educational system, where those inequalities are maintained by society, by our policies, and by our practices. So we want to shift our perspective, and I will move quickly from what's wrong to what's happened. You know, what has happened to a community of people? And that provides context, fosters compassion, and also helps us to see strength in the face of adversity. And so we're thinking, you know, specifically about COVID-19, when we think about the health disparities, you know, what has happened to communities is historical trauma, social cultural trauma, institutional racism, and community level trauma.
Did we lose Santoy?
It looks like she got disconnected.
We will, so we're having a minor technical difficulty, folks. Why don't we just hold on 1 second? Because I think her work will lead into the panel really well, so I don't want to go out of order, but we'll give her another 30 seconds.
She's unable to get in quickly, so she asked that we just move on. And the great thing is Santoy is such a powerful leader in our organization who provides this kind of leadership and education externally and is one of our great resources to also help build our internal capacity. And so I think she covered some really critical foundational aspects today and will not be the last time that we get an opportunity to learn from her and all her brilliance.
Thank you, George. I just want to thank Santoy, and I will when she is able to get back on the line. We'll come now to the third part of our town hall, and that is more of a panel discussion. And I'm proud to introduce Dr. Marcia Treadwell, who is a professor of pediatrics. Oh, you're back, Santoy. Can you hear us? No. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Do you want to? Can you take 5 more minutes and conclude? I'd hate you. You were doing so well. I don't want to cut off the great energy.
I will just share. I think the last piece that I wanted to share was around health equity and our movement, and to really hold the difference between equity and equality, right? And we've seen the images. I'm not going to go to the PowerPoint right now. But the image is of getting what they need. When we think about this in health, right, in healthcare, you know, that people need different things. And I think what we're seeing people pushing for right now is equity in terms of everyone getting what they need in order to be healthy, to be well, and to thrive, to be safe. And also, you know, we hear people pushing for liberation, you know, that there's actually, we can imagine more. We can imagine a world that works for everyone. We can imagine a healthcare system that works for everyone. And that some of those things might, you know, feel radical. Defund the police, what do you mean, right? But we're really looking for prioritizing our communities to have everything that they need, to have the, you know, healthcare and education, to have safe communities. And so I'll pause there. Thank you so much. I am really looking forward to the panel, and I appreciate having the time to share some of these definitions and these terms with you.
Really powerful presentation, as George said. We'll continue this dialogue, and I just sort of want to think behind the scenes, the amazing slides and resources that you showed. I just think we have to figure out a way to be more communal in how we share those, so we can put some thought into that. As I said, now we'll turn to the third part of the town hall. Dr. Marcia Treadwell is co-chair of our DEI committee, professor of pediatrics and a professor of psychiatry, and I would love her to continue the third part of our town hall.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Anderson. We are going to move into this panel discussion with three members of our Benioff Children's Hospitals community. Alvin Hendricks, who's application analyst 3 for the EpiCare Ambulatory. Dr. Michael Bell from the Department of Pediatric Emergency Medicine. And Eji Nameka, the Director of Strategy and Network Development. So it's really an honor to have these three men here to help us as we continue to adhere to our charge and challenge to hold difficult truths, learn from them, and move into action. They're going to share their experiences navigating systemic and structural racism within and outside the walls of our institution. Our goal is to enhance awareness of the manners in which the complex system of racism is developed, maintained, and protected. From there, we can shift our systems and thinking to dismantle it. So my first question for the panel is, tell me about an experience moving through this country as a Black African-American man. What are some things that you have to think about that others have the privilege to take for granted? And you're unmuted, Dr. Bell, so if you would like to start.
Okay, I would like to just to say that as a Black African man, a male, you can't take off your skin and you are always treated different. I remember being in college. I went to a predominantly white college, Syracuse University, and I remember going to my girlfriend's dorm and I was bringing her a life-size doll that I had in a big plastic bag. I go across the street and cars come at me from three different directions. These were police officers who pulled guns on me, told me to lay down in the middle of the street with my hands out. One put a gun to the back of my head while he frisked me. And their excuse for doing this is that they were some kind of task force looking for a Black rapist that were raping white co-eds on my campus. They never said, we're sorry, you know, we did something, you know, we had no reason to do that to you. It was just like, well, so what? We did this to you. It's okay. So people who are not of color cannot understand how it is that you are always a target. When you have a police interaction, you have to think about how can I survive this interaction before you even think about, is something wrong happened here? I was good friends with one of the sheriffs that also worked at Children's Hospital, and he gave me an account how he was stopped by another law enforcement agency running his while he was driving his car and pulled over, and how he had to communicate to this man, I have a gun because I'm a sheriff. And this white police officer would not believe that he was a sheriff. And he says, I'm going for my badge to show you that I'm a sheriff. And the man said, how do I know that badge is for real? Would he have interacted to a white sheriff like that? So, you know, racism is well and alive. And it's something that when you have Black skin, you deal with every day. Disrespect is something, you know, even though I'm a doctor, people always see the color of my skin often and disrespect me just as they disrespect other people.
Thank you for sharing those powerful stories. Alvin, would you like to comment? And the question is related to your experiences and how others have privileges and there are things you can't take for granted.
It's kind of nice to know that I'm in good company with you, Dr. Bell. I've had a gun put to my head by an officer also, and I've also had a guns pulled on me before by officers. The first time was basically I was leaving 102nd and Walnut, just picked up my friend and driving down East 14th, I get pulled over by the time I get to 73rd by five different squad cars. Officer put his gun to my head, called me sweetness, and said all kind of stuff to me to try to make me mad, to make me flinch. He pissed me off, basically, and instead of getting scared about it, I got really, really angry about it. Turns out I was supposedly in a high-speed chase with them down East 14th. Funny, I didn't know that. Ended up just getting let go, so I guess that's a testament to the crime that I actually committed. things that I worry about being a runner, I worry all the time. Like, I don't run at night anymore, and I used to really enjoy that. I always make sure I have ID. You know, I carry very little money on me, no credit cards or anything else, just like $5 or $10, my ID. Make sure that I'm wearing something, usually a race shirt from a race that I've been in, something local that people recognize, and wear bright clothes and try to stay where I'm actually seen. And then I have to still think about not approaching people too fast and, you know, keeping my music cut down or not wearing it at all, you know, so that if someone does tell me to stop, I don't not hear them and get shot just by mistake. And I think the final thing that really just gets under my skin is that I have two sons, and most people who know me know my children. And even their little brother, he's 250, you know, 6'2". So all of my sons are bigger than me. Whenever we go out together, the four of us together in a car, it keeps me petrified. You know, if a cop just so happened to be passing the opposite direction, I'm worried that they're going to turn around and start following me. Things like that.
Thanks, Alvin. So you're with your family, but it's just seen as three, four Black men in a car.
Yeah.
And Edgy, would you like to share?
So sorry about that. I think I know exactly what, you know, what they're talking about. I'll just give two quick examples of things that I've dealt with that have changed how I approach situations. The first one, I was only 10 years old, and I was only 10 years old, and I was with a friend in the neighborhood, and went to go see one of his neighbors, and I'd never been there before, and you know, I'm a skinny preppy kid wearing my corduroy pants and sweater, and we go to the house, and I'll paraphrase just because the language that was used, but I was told, "We don't want any of your kind in here." And so I, you know, at first I was confused. I know what she was talking about. She's like, "No, you're not allowed in here." So all my friends were inside, and turned around, called my parents, and they picked me up and took me home. That was, this is what you should know. This is how you stay safe. This is what you're going to expect for the rest of your life. And you know, that was probably the first major experience I remember. But, you know, growing up throughout the rest of the time, it was playing soccer, you'd hear comments, or, you know, walking down the street, you'd hear comments. When I went to college, people would question whether or not you were there for sports or there for your intellect. My advisor would ask me that, like, "Oh, what team are you on?" "None, I'm a math major." And so you sort of get used to it as you get older, and it deadens you a little bit inside every time it happens. And then I'll just point out the, you know, 2 days ago, it's what I call surprise racism, where I went to go pick up my car from the dealership, and there's a man, and, you know, social distance, we're all standing away from each other, and the man in front looks at me and kind of acts weird, but I ignore him and I wait. And when I go inside, everyone at the counter is like, "Oh, I can't believe you did that. I'm like, what are you guys talking about?" Apparently, the second I got to the dealership and got out of my, you know, Volvo SUV that, you know, everyone knows is a drug dealer's vehicle, with my wife and 2-year-old son in the car, he immediately looked at me and asked them to get for his car keys so he can go hide his bike in the car. And I had no idea about this. And I honestly would have rather not known about it. But it's little things like that where, you know, you're not expecting it, and it just sort of reinforces that this is your life. This is what you should get to. And now I have to figure out, at what age do I have the talk with my son? When do I tell him this is what you're going to deal with for the rest of your life?
Thank you. It's very powerful. I want to move from outside of the walls of children's hospitals to inside. So in our needs assessment, 89% of respondents reported that valuing diversity, equity, and inclusion was an essential aspect of our mission. and yet Blacks and African Americans reported more excluding behaviors compared to other race ethnic subgroups. We feel less respected and perceive leadership in the organization as less committed to inclusiveness and diversity. How do we figure out that discrepancy? What do we make of that? So on the one hand, that the value of diversity, equity, and inclusion is recognized as there, and yet Blacks and African Americans are not enjoying that value. Whoever would like to start.
I'll start with that. You know, I have sat down and met with the last three or four CEOs, presidents of this hospital about diversity. My mentor was Dr. Trevelyan. She basically taught me how to navigate in the children's hospital system. Everybody, you know, Dr. Kendi, you know, makes the difference between being a racist and the opposite, not being a non-racist, but to be an anti-racist. So to be an anti-racist, you have to say, what are you doing to change the racist systems at your institution? So everybody talks a good talk. Everybody says they're totally committed to diversity and inclusion. I've been here 30 years. I came here, I was one of three African-American doctors. 30 years later, male doctors. 30 years later, I am one of two African-American male doctors who are basically staffed at the hospital full-time at this facility. So we have gone backwards. Even though everybody has professed how committed they are to diversity, there is very little diversity. And there's no accountability. If I was the chancellor and I said that, you know, you must do this, and it took you 30 years and you had no progress, I would have fired everybody. There is no accountability. I work in an emergency room that sees 60 to 70% brown and black patients. There is one African-American doctor, yours truly. There is 67 or so white nurses, and there's four black nurses and probably three Latino nurses. That is systems like police departments and health services that don't mirror the people that they serve tend to not protect them at all. And we have done a terrible job. I'm glad to see we're having discussions, but after 30 years, I'm tired of discussions. I want to see actual things change. I want to see that you hired 30 new black doctors, that 30 new black nurses, because one or two is not even the object here. One or two doesn't even change the needle anywhere. We are so far behind with the systemic racism. Systemic racism only allowed this to happen, because if you believe everybody has the same innate ability by God, then these disparities have to be due to racism.
Alvin, I'd like to ask you, what does the organization and BCH leadership need to do to show you that they indeed will be accountable to not only increase diversity, equity, and inclusion within Benny F. Children's Hospitals, but that they'll ensure these changes will last?
From my perspective, I could speak to my past, like basically how I got here. The whole reason I'm at Children's Hospital as a full-time employee is because of Dr. Barbara Staggers and Karen Newmark. They recruited me. I worked here part-time for years. Never would come to Children's full-time because I never felt like they have anything to offer me. You know, I had a full-time nursing job at Alta Base as a maternity nurse, but I did enjoy Children's. I did enjoy the patients, but the management never made me feel comfortable. So after being recruited by Dr. Staggers, I was recruited to open up the clinic at McClyman. So the day that I stepped there, it really was no clinic. I built that place from the ground up. I went from just doing that, it was supposed to be me doing the clinic and leaving, to me staying. So it ended up being me at McClyman's and Roger Mason at Casamont. So Dr. Staggers was like in hog heaven because she had two black male nurses representing her at these two school sites. Well, the thing is that at McClyman's, we had no security. I actually had to be in a physical altercation with a student before we actually got locks on the doors there and security cameras. Before then, our patient could just walk in. They could steal your stuff, anything else. It just didn't matter. And people used to joke about going to the school sites, like, oh, you going over to McClyman's, you better wear your bulletproof vest. That I could never swallow, wasn't really happy about, and just basically dealt with it. The point I'm trying to make is the years that I spent there in adolescent medicine, I functioned as a nurse manager, but never could become one. I became our first lead LVN at our clinic. We tried to hire nurse managers before. I think we had an LVN for, not LVN, an NP for probably about 3 months. And she was white. She drove a Range Rover that she didn't like parking at the school, and she wouldn't see our patients. So she eventually left, but they never actually sought out anything else, anything other than that. And they never felt the need to promote me or even encourage me to use my education leave, which we never get to actually use, to push forward and actually take over the clinic in the way that I should. That's how I ended up with Epic. So I would really like to see the hospital invest in those school sites. Those school sites are our patients. That is Oakland. Those are the people we're supposedly reaching out to. Like, people at Shadelands and out in Walnut Creek don't have to ask for anything. But at McClyman's, at Casamont, you have to beg for stuff. And I think that should stop.
Thank you, Alvin. And Edgy, I'll ask you the same question. What can the leadership do to show you that they will be accountable and that the changes will be lasting?
Yeah, I think, you know, in showing that we're working towards hopefully something lasting. You know, Dr. Wilson touched on it earlier that we should all take a look at ourselves and see what are we doing to actively be anti-racist and actively further diversity, inclusion, equality. But just things that I've seen over the last few days where I've looked up our office of, you know, diversity outreach and all the different programs. There's a certificate program that's theoretically available for diversity inclusion, but seems there's a hard cap on the number of people that can do it, and it seems to have just worked for 1 year and that was it. So it's little things like that where we can not only foster discussion with our peers, but teach each other how to make, you know, more change from the ground up and how to actively raise the bar for, you know, all underrepresented minorities, and you know, it'll the more we can do internally, the better we'll be able to serve our patients. And we have, you know, two very diverse or rather very different patient populations, you know, on the Oakland campus and the San Francisco Mission Bay and Parnassus. And it's true, you need to have your providers at least mostly reflect the demographic breakdown of the patients if you want to have not only the most culturally relevant and culturally accurate care, but the best care for the patients. And I think we should be recruiting more actively, you know, for a more diverse clinical base. We should be recruiting administrators and staff that are more diverse. And we should be inviting, you know, professors, visiting professors. You know, if you invite a black professor to speak, it shouldn't be just about race. They should be speaking about what they have studied, what they've learned. They've gone through the same educational journey that other professors have done. So they should be allowed to speak on what they want to pursue versus what they have to endure.
Thank you so much. We have to end our panel now. We could go on forever, but we do need to move into action, and you guys have great suggestions, and please keep them coming. So I'll turn this back over to Dr. Anderson.
Dr. Treville, thank you so much, and thanks to the panel. That was a very powerful discussion. I want to just call a little bit of an audible. There's 4 minutes left, and I want to be cognizant of people's times. But Kim Murphy, I think you were going to help facilitate some Q&A, and maybe we do that for 3 to 4 minutes before George closes.
Yeah, actually, hi, everybody. Very little in the chat today, so in future town halls, please feel free to share your questions. I do, however, want to acknowledge that we have just had an African-American female colleague of ours share in chat about an experience she literally just had where she was treated very differently to her white male colleagues. I want to let her know that we will be reaching out directly to her, but this was mainly what we received in the chat today, so I can pass it back over to you, Dr. Anderson.
Thank you so much. So in closing, as we anticipated, a very powerful and moving town hall. But once again, we've got to go from words and promises to action. And on behalf of Benioff's senior leadership, I know to a person, we hold that to be core to who we are, to not just talk about something, but to do something. So that's my commitment as the president of Benioff Children's Hospitals. I know my successor will have that same commitment. So without further ado, I would like to have George Weiss close us out. George.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Treadwell and Santoy Trotter and Dr. Bell and Alvin and Edgy for speaking today and for people for participating in these town halls. As Jamie shared, the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee is working really hard to review and use the needs assessment plus these town halls to help formulate an action plan that we will be accountable for in the new fiscal year on the 30th of June. That leadership team is going to meet with the Benioff Children's Hospital leadership to finalize so that we can have a transparent and accountable plan that moves from discussion into to genuine action. And I think that's a really critical piece that we, reality that we're in today and where we should and can evolve to. I'll share something Dr. Bell reminded me. So I'm Puerto Rican and come from a diverse family. My brother is Black, and his two sons are Black as well. And his oldest son is in his second year of college. In his first year of college, in an art program, he needed to create a three-dimensional piece of armor. And what he created was a three-dimensional set of bullseyes that surrounded his entire body. And when I asked him, oh, tell me about this piece you created, he said, well, this is what I feel like when I walk out the door. And that's not right. So I think we all have an opportunity to hold and acknowledge the truths of other of experiences of people of color, hold that discomfort and move it into our responsibility for action. It's really critical that people do not compartmentalize or push down that discomfort, but actually hold it and use it towards our action and accountability. As we move on, I am really proud to be a member of this team with you all. My abuelita, which is my grandmother, often says, dime con quien andas, si te diré quien eres, which means tell me who you walk with and I'll tell you who you are. And I'm really proud to walk with you on this journey as we really work together with accountability to dismantle structural and societal racism, looking internally at ourselves as we move forward. So thank you.
Thank you, George. Good day, everybody. Be safe.